Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 157. It's Monday, April 4th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, COVID-19 is still definitely in the news and around. To do a national summary, we basically have good news, bad news. We have likely reached our low in actual daily cases. Now, I say actual daily cases because we probably have quite a bit of underreporting at this time since testing has really dropped. And BA2, the cousin of the original Omicron, is now the dominant variant in the U.S. and growing faster than BA1, the original Omicron one, which is receding. And the BA2 is growing at about 40% each week, week over week. If this trajectory continues, we'll see about 40,000 new cases per day by mid-April and possibly 100,000 cases per day by mid-May. Test positivity rates have started increasing. The good news is that we are starting this next surge at quite lower daily counts. This is different from the UK, for instance, which is getting pummeled with record cases right now after not getting cases down more than about two-thirds from their peak. Their hospitalization rates for elderly have exceeded the recent Omicron peak. In the U.S., we have reached record low COVID-19 hospitalizations with over a 90% reduction from our peak. Good news. Springtime weather should be on our side, but this may be more than offset by our increasingly relaxed mitigation efforts. The southern U.S. states may see surges this summer when hot weather drives people indoors. The bottom line, though, is BA2's behavior has varied greatly between countries for reasons that are not entirely clear. So, what happens here in the U.S. is still very uncertain. But of course, in the ongoing pandemic game, there is a new variant that's been identified in the UK and I believe Thailand. It's called XC and it's a recombinant of Omicron BA1 and BA2 strains. The World Health Organization has said that early tests show it could be more transmissible than the BA2, which is the most transmissible we've seen, which of course replaced BA1, which was previously the most transmissible we've seen. Okay, well, let's get to a little better news and go to the Lucas County COVID-19 report. This has been a story of a reversal of fortune as Ohio is really battered over the winter months and for months on end was one of the worst off states. We had the highest death rates of any state for a while there. But now, today, Ohio is actually better off than the U.S. as a whole, which as a whole is doing pretty good for today. The Lucas County average of daily cases is dropped a little bit more. It's sort of leveled out here, but it's the last couple of weeks it's dropped from 15 to 12, but that's a fairly low number and a lot lower than what we saw even a month ago. We were seeing four times that month, and a couple of weeks before that we were seeing double that, so it's dropping fast. The testing positivity rates in both Lucas County and Ohio are dropping slightly and are at just over 2%. In the United States, though, we're seeing a little bit of reversal here, and this is the BA2 that's starting to show up in the Northeast and elsewhere. And we have seen that the positivity rate has crept up to 2.7% from 2.3% a couple weeks ago. This is still a pretty low rate, but as I indicated earlier, it looks like we're seeing a reversal that'll work its way through the country. But where the peak will end up, nobody really knows for sure. Okay, well, in other good news, long-term care facilities are down to only 7 active cases in the most recent week, down from 17 a couple weeks ago the last time I reported, and no additional deaths. And we're seeing that similar trend nationally with a record low of nursing home deaths in the pandemic so far. University of Toledo, which a couple weeks ago had 0 reported cases, had 5 and 6 the last 2 weeks. Still very low numbers, historically what they've had, but of course COVID is still here and brewing. Hospitalizations are still slowly declining, and they're at about 400 in Ohio, but this is down from a peak of about 6,000. Woo! So way over 90% less. Good job. Deaths nationally are still dropping steadily and down to about 600 per day, although I would note this is still easily the number 3 leading cause of death in the U.S. today behind heart disease and cancer. There's a big cluster of 4, 5, and 6 that happen around 3, 4, 500 deaths per day. So we're getting down to that neighborhood, and hopefully we will drop COVID from number 3 to 4 and 5 and 6 and maybe 7, 8, 9, or 10. Okay, haven't reported on vaccinations for a while, 5 weeks to be exact, and it looks like we have the same slow, I'll be optimistic and say steady increase, but it is very slow. It looks like we're going to have to go a couple months or so to get a 1% increase in number of people fully vaccinated in this country. We're doing a little better doing extra boosters, whether that's the 3rd or the 4th shot. But we still have less than 30% of the population that's been boosted at all. And the vaccination rates for a complete vaccination series is only 56.2% in Lucas County. Okay, well, turning our attention still on COVID-19, but to the national toll here. We are about to reach a new landmark in this pandemic in this country. And to talk about that in some detail, this article from Scientific American, what 1 million COVID dead mean for USA's future. The U.S. will record 1 million confirmed deaths from COVID in the next several weeks. This toll is likely an undercount because there are more than 200,000 other excess deaths that go beyond typical mortality rates, caused in part by lingering effects of the disease and the strain of the pandemic. These immense losses are shaping our country, how we live, work, and love, how we play and pray and learn and grow. We will see the rippling effects of the pandemic on our society and the way it impacts individuals for generations, says Naisha Black, Director of Demographic Research at the University of Alabama. This is definitely a huge marker in the way we will think about society moving forward. It will be that anchor event. COVID has become the 3rd leading cause of death in the U.S. after heart disease and cancer. These deaths have wide-ranging consequences. The effects on children may be the longest lasting. In the U.S., an estimated 250,000 children have lost a caregiver to COVID, including 194,000 who lost one or both parents. And the psychological and economic aftershocks can give a lifetime of negative impacts on their education and career. Certain communities have been hit especially hard, with older Americans and people of color suffering disproportionately. About 3/4 of the dead, or around 730,000, have been people aged 65 and older. Many of them were otherwise healthy, and statistically would have lived many more years, says Jennifer Dowd, a demographer at the University of Oxford. Their passing leaves a giant hole, she notes. We're probably not accounting for all the ways in which we rely on that age group to contribute to society, from caring for grandkids to providing stable intergenerational family structures. On average, every death from COVID leaves 9 people grieving. In the U.S., there are 54 million people aged 65 and older in 2019, and since then, the coronavirus has killed 1 out of every 74 of them. These deaths are more concentrated in even older populations, More than a quarter have occurred in those age 85 and older, and another quarter have been in those age 75 to 84. Younger people have not escaped. About 240,000 Americans between the ages of 18 and 64 have died, nearly a quarter of the total toll. Among working-age Americans, we are seeing right now the highest death rates we have ever seen in the history of this business, said J. Scott Davison, CEO of the insurance company One America. Death rates are up 40% over what they were pre-pandemic. For comparison, he said, a 1 in a 200-year catastrophe would lead to a 10% increase, so 40% is just unheard of. People are dying in the prime of life, said Andrew Stokes, an assistant professor of global health at the Boston University School of Public Health. They're leaving families. They were caregivers. When we think about the children left behind, the single moms and single dads who don't have a partner any longer, that's going to create inequality and inequity that will be experienced for years to come. Those lost took others to the doctor or checked in on friends or neighbors to make sure they were eating well and their blood pressure or sugar levels were okay. What does it mean when these ties have been broken, Black asks. Can you put these pieces back together? And certain types of work were hit harder by COVID than others. Those in fields such as food and agriculture, warehouse operations and manufacturing, and transportation and construction saw higher rates of death than in many other occupations. And working in a nursing home has been one of the deadliest jobs in the U.S. A lot of us demographers have been tallying the losses, and it kind of snuck up on us, the scale of it all, Dowd says. We never thought it would keep going like this. Such devastation has not been seen since World War II, when about 418,000 Americans died, she says. We're going to be trying to understand these long-term effects on health and mortality for a long time. In certain communities or certain economic groups, there's not a lot of room for error. You don't have a safety net in terms of the economic resources if you lost someone, and they were a contribution to the household. So those disruptions can be more long-term, or the effect of them can be more detrimental. Not all of these resources are part of the official economy. A lot of communities that are lower income, for example, they may not go to the private market to purchase childcare, Black says. So what happens when you don't have your grandmother around or your mother around, who can now watch your child? Losing childcare can affect a parent's ability to work, making it more difficult to provide for the family. More than 1 million women left the workforce during the pandemic, in large part because of childcare disruptions. A lot of that childcare came from grandparents, who play an integral role in children's lives, providing emotional and financial support. More than 80% of Americans aged 65 or older are grandparents, and about 1 in 5 provide childcare regularly, according to a 2015 Pew Research Center survey. In 2019, grandparents provided housing for 4.5 million children. Grandparents of color are more likely to help financially and logistically. According to a survey reported in 2012, more than half of Hispanic or Latino grandparents say they provided childcare for 5 years or more. And African-American grandparents were most likely to be their grandparents' primary caregivers compared to other groups, making the disproportionate loss from COVID in communities of color even greater. After a primary caregiver's death, kids often have a higher risk of many problems. More than half of kids report having significant mental health issues. Losses also put children at greater risk for physical, emotional, and sexual violence, poverty, suicide, teen pregnancy, and infectious and chronic illnesses. Losing a caregiver can worsen feelings of abandonment, affect self-esteem, and make it harder to cope with stress. The difficulties extend to kids' education. Children who lose a parent tend to see their performance at school suffer, and that in turn harms future income and family stability. In social epidemiology, we think about these effects as a long arm of childhood trauma, effects that exert themselves throughout the life course, Stokes says. It's kind of a direct path from education to economic viability and security, or having more precarious employment. For children, the aged, and the rest of society, experts expect to see a long-term worsening trajectory of health and survival in coming years. One reason is the effect of long COVID, a cluster of debilitating symptoms, including fatigue, headache, pain, and shortness of breath that can last for months after an initial infection. The syndrome may also result in increased mortality, with people dying months after contracting the virus. Delays in getting health care created by the crush of acute and long COVID patients during the pandemic may lead to higher death rates for people who have developed diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and other conditions. The U.S. already had a crisis of chronic disease, especially in working-age people, which is one reason why the coronavirus wreaked havoc. there's an interaction with these chronic diseases, and it's increasing the mortality risk from those conditions. These losses are particularly hard because many people did not have a chance to say goodbye in person or mourn with others. The risk of infection was too dangerous. We didn't get to grieve as we would traditionally. This problem is made worse by survivors' sense that a large number of Americans do not want to acknowledge the horrifying toll or learn from it moving forward. Instead, people and pundits proclaim that they are, quote, done with COVID. Many do not want the country to wallow in grief. Rather, they want the U.S. to use the emotion to galvanize action. This is a major disrupting event, and it gives us the opportunity to think about how we actually want to rebuild. We're a country that's so deeply divided. We can start to see one another as Americans and humans if we can hold space for what we've been through in this moment. Okay, well, as vaccines play an essential role in the long-term battle against COVID-19, we have this from Stat News. Narrowing the vaccine gap as boosters begin for people over 50. The Food and Drug Administration last week authorized a second booster for individuals 50 and older. Although some people over the age of 50 are mulling whether and how soon to get their fourth jab, a significant vaccine gap exists within this group, which needs to be addressed. There are over 118 million Americans over the age of 50. 18 million, or 15% of these individuals, are not fully vaccinated, and 59 million, or half of them, have not received their first booster. Closing that gap will be a challenge, especially given that the Health Resources and Services Administration on March 22nd stopped accepting claims for COVID testing for the uninsured, and on April 6th will do the same for vaccines. Millions of uninsured patients will no longer have the protection vaccination confers and will be denied access to free COVID tests and treatments. Eligible patients, including those with fragile medical conditions in search of monoclonal antibodies, will struggle to access outpatient treatment, likely leading to a rise in hospitalizations. Without swift approval from Congress for emergency COVID-19 funds, the cost of inaction will inevitably lead to dire consequences for the most vulnerable. Many Americans are not up to date with their COVID-19 vaccine. A recent New England Journal of Medicine paper shows that those infected with the original Omicron strain and not previously vaccinated had antibodies that proved to be largely ineffective at protecting against other viral strains. Communication with the public should emphasize the importance of vaccines, how they protect the vulnerable from severe disease, long COVID, and death, and how their protection wanes over time. All Americans need to have reliable access to vaccines, including the millions of Americans who have contracted Omicron. So I want to highlight in that where it says that those who got infected with the original Omicron strain and not been previously vaccinated, those antibodies are largely ineffective at protecting against the other viral strains that we've had. And of course, this may very well mean future viral strains. So if you've been, quote, immunized by Omicron, well, it provides definitely some protection, but it does not necessarily provide good protection for the next strain coming out. Vaccines and boosters have proven to be highly protective against severe outcomes. A recent CDC study found that three doses of an mRNA vaccine were 94% effective against requiring ventilation or death, even during the Omicron surge. During Omicron, two doses were 79% effective against the same outcomes. Without congressional approval for new funds, we will face a cliff in discovery and development of promising new vaccine candidates. This includes next-generation vaccines to broaden protection against future variants and extend the duration of protection and the shelf life of the vaccine to decrease costs. All Americans deserve to benefit from protection of these life-saving vaccines. Congress must pass the bill to ensure states can lead and undertake three important steps. First, efforts must continue to reach the unvaccinated. The pace of new vaccinations is among the lowest since the rollout began, yet there is still some untapped potential in reaching the unvaccinated. According to a recent Economist YouGov poll, 31% of those who say they are unvaccinated express interest in receiving a vaccine in the future, including 32% of Americans with lower household incomes. Increasing vaccine access through mobile and school clinics can help people start their vaccination series. Second, the pace of booster administration must accelerate. Boosters help maintain protection against severe disease and will blunt the effects of BA2 in this latest surge. Yet only half of those eligible have received a booster. Particularly of concern is low booster uptake in older age groups. 40% of individuals over the age of 65 have not been boosted. That's 22 million elderly. In nursing homes, only 67% of residents and 41% of staff have been boosted. There's much that needs to be done to protect those most at risk for severe outcomes. Proactive outreach includes calls, text messages, and scheduling appointments for Medicaid enrollees. Primary care physicians should stress the importance of remaining fully protected and offer boosters during appointments. Rather than leaving the scheduling administration of booster doses up to nursing homes, health departments should schedule emergency nursing home booster clinics for these facilities with low rates. Third, with this phase of vaccinations, investment in the equitable distribution and delivery of all tools should be ramped up. The Omicron wave took an unequal toll on many Americans. Americans with lower household incomes were more likely to report having to miss work during the Omicron surge, which also resulted in economic disruption. In many areas, child vaccination rates are stratified along income lines. Although great strides were made to reduce inequities last spring, the booster rollout has perpetuated lower vaccination rates in Black and Hispanic Americans. Improving access to and uptake of vaccine doses in low-income and minority populations should be a top priority. These three steps will all require federal resources. Failure to provide those resources could result in a reversal of the progress we have made so far. Without further funding, 28 million uninsured Americans who already have lower vaccination rates will have fewer options for vaccination. Increasing vaccination rates, specifically among those more vulnerable to severe outcomes, is a key strategy to help abate BA2's morbidity and mortality and minimize the potential disruption to health services for all. And drilling down to another vulnerable population, this from Stat News, COVID-19 pandemic isn't over for Black Americans, report warns. A searing report released by the Black Coalition Against COVID details the immense toll that COVID-19 pandemic has taken and continues to take on Black communities and calls for continued vigilance and action to prevent further losses, even as the rest of the nation is eager to move on. The report details the massive disparities, including not just higher overall cases and death rates, but also economic harms experienced by Black Americans. These include older Black Americans, those between 65 and 74, were 5 times more likely to die than white Americans of the same age. Between April 2020 and June 2021, 1 in 310 Black children lost a parent or caregiver, compared to 1 in 738 white children. Learning time lost by students who are Black or in other racial or ethnic groups was estimated to be 1 year, compared to 4 to 8 months for white students. Black Americans were twice as likely as white Americans to experience food insecurity. Black Americans are more likely to experience pandemic-related anxiety, depression, and substance use disorders compared with white Americans. The report states clearly that these worse outcomes were not due to any biological factors or genetic predisposition, but were a predictable result of structural and social realities, such as Black Americans being overrepresented in essential worker jobs, including practical and vocational nursing, being more likely to live in densely populated urban areas, and having pre-existing medical conditions such as hypertension and diabetes due to differential access to healthcare. In addition, the report says many Black Americans face barriers to testing and vaccination at the beginning of the pandemic, and also face discrimination when seeking COVID-19 care. The harsh realities of COVID-19 were superimposed upon generational systems of disadvantage, said the report. The report shows that disparities can be erased with targeted action. The Black Coalition Against COVID was among groups led by Black physicians and political and church leaders that worked to limit disparities in COVID-19 vaccination rates through education and access efforts. In May 2021, vaccination rates for first and second doses were 10% and 12% lower than those for white Americans. By January 22, however, that gap had been largely erased. We cannot unlearn the lessons we have learned these past 2 years. I have a visceral reaction every time someone says we have to get back to normal, because normal is what got us here. We need to get back to a new normal. Whew, a better normal. Please make it so. Okay, next up from CNN, another vaccination story, this time highlighting children. In about half of U.S. counties, less than 10% of children ages 5 to 11 are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. The youngest group eligible to be vaccinated against COVID-19 in the U.S., children ages 5 to 11, is also the least vaccinated one. In about half of U.S. counties, less than 10% of children aged 5 to 11 are fully vaccinated. Most of the counties with especially low child vaccination rates are in the South, where nearly two-thirds of counties have vaccinated fewer than 1 in 10 children, age 5 to 11. This has been a constant concern for all of us, said Dr. Yvonne Maldonado, chair of the American Academy of Pediatrics Committee on Infectious Diseases. It's very disturbing to see that families just haven't embraced vaccination. About 1,500 counties have less than 10% of this age group vaccinated, including more than 500 counties that have less than 5% of this age group vaccinated. Overall, about 66% of the U.S. population is fully vaccinated, including three-quarters of adults and nearly 90% of seniors, according to the CDC. Even among adolescents aged 12 to 17, the vaccination rate is higher than 50% nationally. But even though they've been eligible for vaccination for nearly 5 months, less than 28% of children aged 5 to 11 are fully vaccinated. Of more than 3,100 counties in the U.S., only a few dozen have fully vaccinated more than half of this age group. The recent Omicron wave pushed children case numbers and hospitalizations to the highest levels of the pandemic. A study published last Wednesday in the New England Journal of Medicine found vaccination to be a key factor in preventing hospitalization in that time period. The researchers, including some from the CDC, found that vaccination reduced the risk of hospitalization for 5 to 11-year-olds by 68% during the Omicron wave. Like adults, children who are immunocompromised or have risk factors such as obesity or asthma may be at higher risk of becoming seriously ill with COVID. But with many children, it's not clear why they end up in the hospital and others don't. We can't risk stratify children, Maldonado said. We can't predict which children are going to be at risk for hospitalizations. So there you go, the need for widespread vaccination. Okay, well, next up, let's look at this story from the Cincinnati Inquirer. Ohio's mild flu season is punctuated by its initial pediatric flu death, an eight-month-old boy. An eight-month-old boy from Ashland County is the first pediatric flu death of the season, the Ohio Department of Health reported last Friday. Following an unusually slow season that saw only 108 hospitalizations statewide in 2020-2021, Ohio's reported 972 flu-associated hospitalizations so far this season. At this point, during the 2019-2020 flu season, for example, the state saw 10,540 hospitalizations related to the flu. Abnormally low numbers from 2020 to 2021 were a product of COVID-19 restrictions and social distancing efforts, experts say. So basically, the first year of the COVID pandemic, we had an over 90% drop in flu hospitalizations, and that is actually going back up. It went down to 108 in that first year. I mean, the most recent one, it's bumped back up to 972 hospitalizations. So it's still a fraction of what it was pre-pandemic, but it's just an indication that protecting ourselves from COVID protects our children from flu very well. Okay, well, one of the hallmarks of COVID is that it affects a lot of different organs and tissues. It makes it particularly deadly. So let's look at this story from Medical Express. Risk and burden of diabetes up after acute SARS-CoV-2 infection. In analyses that estimated the risk for incident diabetes or anti-hyperglycemic use, the hazard ratio was 1.46%. That's a 46% increase, and excess burden was 18 cases per 1,000 people at 12 months. There was an increase in a graded manner in the risks and burdens of post-acute outcomes based on the severity of COVID-19. So actually, even mild cases increase the risk for diabetes. And overall, it increased diabetes by 46%. And this basically means that at 12 months, those people that were infected, 1.8% of them ended up being diagnosed with diabetes or were given an anti-hyperglycemic, which is essentially the same thing. Now, we have approximately 10% of the population that's diagnosed with diabetes. So this means if you get half your population, you can actually increase the total number of diabetics by about 10%. So that may not seem like a lot, but that's a huge amount in 1 year to jump up the number of diabetics in the U.S. Okay, well, next up from Axios, an interesting study on pregnancy and COVID. Pregnancy nearly doubles the risk of breakthrough COVID. Pregnancy nearly doubles the chances a person will have a breakthrough COVID-19 infection. The researchers analyzed millions of patient records to home in on what comorbidities increase a person's risk of contracting the coronavirus while fully vaccinated. Pregnancy topped the list, according to the findings first reported by the Washington Post. Pregnant individuals were 1.9 times more likely to have a breakthrough case when compared to the rest of the population. those with organ transplants were 1.8 times more likely to get COVID when vaccinated. Patients with an immune deficiency were 1.6 times more likely to get breakthrough COVID, researchers found. The study did not find any increase or decrease with those who had Down syndrome or cancer. So what are they saying? These findings support the CDC's recommendation that patients with high-risk comorbidity may need to use enhanced infection prevention control beyond vaccination to minimize the risk of a COVID-19 breakthrough infection. In other words, pregnant folks need to be a little bit more concerned, even if they're fully vaccinated. Now, this is pretty surprising, particularly that it was even more likely than those with organ transplants and, you know, immunodeficiency. But some of this may actually be because since pregnant people are way more likely to interface with healthcare and be perhaps personally concerned about COVID-19 infection, they may be more likely to be identified and tested. So that may jack up a little bit these numbers. So if you're able to adjust for that, it might be a little bit lower. But either case, it looks like pregnant individuals, even though they're fully vaccinated, the pregnancy itself is a risk factor for a breakthrough infection. Okay, well, let's switch gears and look across the pond to the United Kingdom. This is from Medical Express. UK's COVID infections hit record high as free tests end. Rates for COVID infection have hit a record high in the UK just as free government testing ended for millions in England. It said 1 in 13 people in England are estimated to have had COVID during that week, up from 1 in 16 the week before. The rate in Scotland was higher still at 1 in 12. The rapid rise continues to be fueled by the growth of the Omicron BA2 variant across the UK. Tim Spector, professor of epidemiology at King's College London, told Times Radio the timing of the government's end of free testing in England, quote, couldn't really be worse. From last Friday, most people in England have to pay for their own test kits for COVID. Free testing will only be available in healthcare settings. With the end of COVID rules, people may well assume infections are dwindling, but the reality is that cases have been soaring, which means scrapping all isolation rules and ending free tests is a dangerous gamble. However, Health Secretary Sajid Javid said most people that people must, quote, learn to live with COVID. This is a phrase that I am learning to hate and despise, learning to live. Well, basically what they're saying is learn to live without, in this case, screening. So would we accept that? Would that fly, learning to live with cancer, learning to live with heart disease? You know, it's like, oh, don't bother getting screened for cancer or heart disease. Just learn to live with it. It's kind of ridiculous. But I suppose a trauma-informed view would be that we've been traumatized and we just want to get out of this. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's very adaptive or healthy. And next up from the New York Times, cuts in Britain could cause a COVID data drought. The British government last Friday shut down or scaled back a number of its COVID surveillance programs, curtailing the collection of data that the United States and many other countries had come to rely on to understand the threat posed by emerging variants and the effectiveness of vaccines. Denmark, too, renowned for its insights from its comprehensive tests, has drastically cut back on its virus tracking efforts in recent months. As more countries loosen their policies toward living with COVID rather than snuffing it out, health experts worry that monitoring systems will become weaker, making it more difficult to predict new surges and make sense of emerging variants. Things are going to get harder now, Samuel Scarpino, a managing director at the Rockefeller Foundation's Pandemic Prevention Institute, said. And right as things get hard, we're dialing back the data systems. Okay, well, let's get a little island of good news here. Little bit here, this from Medical Express. Biden administration launches COVID website for one-stop info. The Biden administration is launching what it says is a one-stop website that will help people in the United States access COVID-19 tests, vaccines, and treatments, along with status updates on infection rates where they live. You can see this by going to COVID.gov. That's COVID.gov. Now, with a click of a button, people will be able to find where to access all of these tools, the White House said. People will also be able to find the latest data from the CDC in their community. Okay, I'll switch gears a little bit and look at some supply chain issues. This from Axios. Shortages stretch across healthcare supply chain. Surgical supplies for chest drainage, fluids required for dialysis, and even old-fashioned hot and cold packs are among a list of items in shortage across healthcare, group purchasing organization Premier told Axios. why it matters. Sustained high-level supply chain shortages have stretched across all areas of healthcare, and they're expected to continue through the end of 2022, David Hargrave, Senior Vice President of Premier, said. While it's natural for supply chains to have back orders and shortages, about 8 to 10 times as many items are in short supply at any given time compared to before the pandemic, he said. Additional products like disposable containers for needles, sterile gloves, and ECG electrode cables have been put on Premier's watch list. What's happening? Inflation, the way simultaneous outbreaks of COVID in China slowed some production and shipping, and conflicts in Ukraine are contributing to the disruptions. What to watch? The semiconductor market, which relies on neon, of which Ukraine is the major producer, Hargrave said. Supplies aren't short yet, but there are longer lead times. They are in pretty much every electronic medical device, Hargrave said. Yeah, and many other devices as well. Okay, well, let's switch gears and get off COVID a bit. This from Medical Express. Cities are making us fat and healthy and unhealthy. A healthy location index can help us plan better. Health issues like this are often thought of in terms of personal responsibility. However, this approach diverts focus away from health systems, governments, and physical environments. The global rise in obesity since 1980 has occurred too rapidly for genetic or biological factors to be its root cause. Instead, it may actually just be a normal response to environments that provide easy access to energy-dense, nutrient-poor foods and a range of unhealthy options that require us expending very little energy. Think about it. Maintaining good health in our current environment requires a lot of effort. Why? Because healthy food choices are often more difficult than convenient ones. Be that trying to avoid fast food outlets or conveniently placed liquor stores, the lack of access to fresh fruit and vegetables, or deciding to cycle rather than drive the car. This is known as an obesogenic environment, and it needs to change. This change comes with an understanding of how things currently stand, which is where the Healthy Location Index comes in. Data used in our index includes quantifying access to five health-constraining features: fast food outlets, takeaway outlets, convenience stores, alcohol outlets, and gaming venues. We also quantify five health-promoting features: green spaces, blue spaces, that is accessible outdoor water environments, physical activity facilities, fruit and vegetable outlets, and supermarkets. This phenomenon is well known as a form of environmental injustice, which ultimately stems from a lack of equity in the development, implementation, and enforcement of environmental laws, regulations, and policies. We need to ask whether we really need that additional fast food outlet or liquor store in the same neighborhood. We hope the index can help policymakers consider how to shape more health-friendly cities by regulating or adding the right features. After all, the protection and promotion of public health is a core responsibility of government, and it should not be left to individuals, families, or communities to create such changes. And another community intervention, this from Medical Express. Subsidy would improve fruit and vegetable intake by as much as 15%, says economists. High fixed costs for retailing fresh fruit and vegetables means that they cost 40% more than would be efficient, unlike unhealthy alternatives which trade close to marginal cost, a new study demonstrates. Introducing a subsidy to counteract the price distortion and reduce the cost of fruit and vegetables will change diets in a way that is not only healthier, but also more in line with what consumers like to eat, according to research. Whew, win-win. The economists found that fixed costs in the supply chain play a much larger role in the price of fruit and vegetables than in prices of other foods, distorting the relative price by at least 40%. These high prices imply that consumers on average buy 15% less fruit and vegetables than they would have if these sold at marginal cost. This underconsumption is due to a market imperfection. The fixed costs prevent the, quote, invisible hand of the market from allocating more fruits and vegetables to consumers, which both they and the producers of these products would prefer. The 15% underconsumption of fruits and vegetables due to retail market imperfections accounts for a third of the gap between the average amounts of fruit and vegetable consumed and the recommended intake. So that'd be one third of the solution right there. There is something wrong with the market, which is that there's a high fixed cost in the provision of fruits and vegetables. The effect is that the prices are too high and consumption is too low. What is worse, the effect is stronger when demand is low, and demand happens to be low where people are poor. So the market failure not only makes us all unhealthier, but it increases health inequality as well. There's no debate that fruit and vegetable consumption would increase if you subsidize it. The main contribution of our research is to show that the market is already so distorted that this subsidy would benefit every single consumer in the economy. Okay, next up from the Washington Post, almost 800,000 Americans are living with end-stage kidney disease. At least 78,000 adults in the United States are living with end-stage kidney disease, according to a report from the CDC. It found that from 2000 to 2019, new cases of end-stage disease increased by 42%, and the number of people living with this stage of disease, called prevalent cases, roughly doubled. An estimated one-half of Americans will eventually develop chronic kidney disease. Yikes. The kidneys, two fist-sized organs in your back just below your rib cage, filter your blood, removing excess fluids and waste. Other diseases, conditions, or injuries, most often diabetes or hypertension, could also damage the kidneys, leading to a gradual loss of kidney function, known as chronic kidney disease. Over time, this can advance to kidney failure or end-stage disease, meaning the kidneys can no longer work as they should. As a result, dangerous levels of fluids and waste can build up in the body. The only available treatments are dialysis or a kidney transplant. About 1 in 7 adults, or about 37 million people, have chronic kidney disease, according to the National Institute of Diabetes, Digestive, and Kidney Diseases. Most people, as many as 90%, the agency says, however, are not aware they have kidney disease when it is in its early stages, as symptoms often do not develop until the disease becomes more advanced. Also, just like to plug that there's basic nutritional things that are driving this as well. High consumption of animal protein and high salt diet is very difficult on the kidney and pushes it to its max and decreases its capacity over years and years of diet. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. I am broadcasting from the John Snow Memorial Studio. Next up from Medical Express, fewer than 6% of criminal justice cases get opioid use disorder treatment. About 4 million people who reported use or misuse of prescription opioids or heroin in 2014 also reported having concurrent arrest or active probation or parole status. Individuals who report opiate use are significantly more likely to have been arrested compared to those who do not use opioids. Opioid agonist treatments, which include federally approved medications such as methadone, buprenorphine, and naltrexone, reduce withdrawal symptoms and cravings as well as block the effects of opioid use and reduce the risk of death by 33%. Yet, this treatment among justice-involved individuals is relatively rare. Results of the study published in the journal Substance Use and Misuse showed that fewer than 6% of criminal justice cases received opioid agonist treatment as part of their treatment plan. Those with daily substance use, comorbid psychiatric problems, prior treatment, females, Latinos, and those who were older and those who were living independently were more likely to receive this treatment, as were those living in the Northeast and with government health insurance. The criminal justice system is well positioned to facilitate an individual's engagement in effective care at several intervention points, including contact with first responders, case adjudication, sentencing, supervision, and reentry, said Wendy Gustafaro, senior author and director and associate professor of the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice. We know that opioid agonist treatment is related to better outcomes for justice-involved individuals, including reduced opioid use, reduced overdose deaths, improved treatment engagement, reduced criminal behavior, and lower crime costs. However, only a fraction of justice-involved individuals receive this treatment, even though its effectiveness is well established. Although largely framed as a problem that affects white individuals, opioid use has had significant and growing impact in communities of color as well. Between 2010 and 2018, opioid overdose deaths increased 350% among black individuals and 220% for Hispanic individuals. Dismantling barriers to treatment can improve both public health and community safety. The criminal justice system must reduce regulatory burdens and systemic resistance to opioid agonist treatment while increasing funding for access to treatment to effectively serve those struggling with opioid use disorder. And boy, what a commentary. Of course, the substance use disorder is where has a huge interface with the criminal justice system. In fact, drives addiction drives a lot of criminal behavior. So it would make a lot of sense that we put effective treatment for those that have substance use disorder that get involved with the criminal justice system. Okay, well, switch gears and do some family planning stories to hear from. This is from Medical Express. United Nations report, nearly half of all pregnancies are unintended. The UN Population Fund says new research shows that nearly half of all pregnancies worldwide, 121 million annually, are unintended, which it calls a neglected crisis. In its annual State of World Population Report 2022, the fund said over 60% of unintended pregnancies end in abortion, and an estimated 45% of abortions are unsafe, causing 5 to 13% of all maternal deaths. This report is a wake-up call, said Dr. Natalia Kanim, executive director of the fund, which now calls itself the UN Sexual and Reproductive Health Agency. The staggering number of unintended pregnancies represents a global failure to uphold women and girls' basic human rights. For the women affected, the most life-altering reproductive choice, whether or not to become pregnant, is no choice at all, she said. The rate of unintended pregnancy did not decline between 1990 and 2019. Did decline from 79 to 64 for every 1,000 women aged 15 to 49, and that offers, quote, some comfort, the report said. But it noted the total number of women experiencing unintended pregnancies increased about 13% over the 30-year period because of population growth. According to the fund's research, an estimated 257 million women globally who want to avoid pregnancy are not using safe and modern methods of contraception. And in a subset of 47 countries, about 40% of sexually active women were not using any contraceptive methods. UN data this year looking at women of reproductive age in 64 countries showed that 23% were unable to say no to sex, 24% were unable to make decisions about their own health care, and 8% were unable to make decisions about contraception, the report said. Together, this means that only 57% of women are able to make their own decisions over their sexual and reproductive rights. Preventing unintended pregnancies is a non-negotiable first step towards gender equality. When individuals are able to exercise real informed choice over their health, bodies, and futures, they can contribute to a more prosperous society and a more sustainable, equitable, and just world. Amen. And back in the U.S., on a similar story, this from the 19th, they just gave up. More than two-thirds of the military community report challenges to building a family. The largest annual military lifestyle survey found that the majority of respondents experienced challenges to having children, with women and LGBTQ service members disproportionately impacted. For the first time, the survey included specific questions to better understand family-building challenges among National Guardsmen, Reserve Service members, veterans, and their families. More than two-thirds of the respondents said they had faced a family-building challenge at some point in their lives, and nearly half said military service specifically hindered their desired number of children or desired time between births. The final survey results included more than 8,000 members of the military community. The answers revealed widespread struggles. Women and LGBTQ service members were nearly twice as likely to mention family-building challenges, including tracking ovulation, taking hormone-based medication, trying in vitro fertilization, or navigating adoption processes while continually moving across state lines. Some voiced concerns about the impact pregnancy might have on their careers. Active duty service members are generally 17 to 40 years old, about the same range as the Center for Disease Control and Prevention's definition of, quote, women of childbearing age. Okay, well, let's do a kid story from Ohio, this from the Columbus Dispatch. Ohio kids being sent out of state for mental health treatment. The Public Children's Service Association of Ohio released a survey of a representative county children's services agency showing that nearly 1 in 4, or 24% of kids who came into custody last year did so primarily due to significant mental health needs, developmental or intellectual disabilities, or as a diversion from juvenile corrections. Finding appropriate and available placements for these youth has led to a crisis impacting county children's service agencies across Ohio. These kids entered foster care last year, not primarily because of abuse or neglect, but because children's services has become the system of last resort. Ohio needs more community-based alternatives that could better serve youth at home. Hospitals lack the capacity to meet their acute needs and provide mental health crisis stabilization. Ohio lacks foster families trained and willing to take youth with challenging behaviors. Unfortunately, the only option for many of these youths is a mental health treatment facility. These facilities are struggling with workforce challenges, including reduced capacity or lack of staff trained to manage complex behaviors. With limited options, agencies too often make the desperate decision to send youth out of state for treatment. Yeah, it just reminds me all the rhetoric about family values. So the question, I suppose, is do all kids matter? Of course they do, but that's a matter of equality. But with inequity, that is definitely not the case. Next up from Bloomberg News, over 22% of U.S. high schoolers identify as not heterosexual, says CDC study. One in five high school students does not identify as heterosexual, and many say they face mental health challenges in the past year, a federal study finds. The findings are in keeping with a Gallup poll released last month in which almost 21% of Generation Z respondents age 18 and over identified as members of the LGBTQ community, more than any other generation. While one in three students said they experienced poor mental health consistently during the COVID-19 pandemic, the CDC found the numbers increased for LGBTQ students. They were more likely to report poor mental health, as well as thoughts of suicide or suicide attempts. They were also less likely to report feeling close to others at school than those who did not identify as LGBTQ. Three in four LGBTQ students said that they have been subjected to emotional abuse by a parent in the last year. Yikes. And LGBTQ students were twice as likely as their heterosexual counterparts to say they had been subjected to physical abuse by a parent or another adult in their home. Students need our support now more than ever, whether by making sure that their schools are inclusive and safe or providing opportunities to engage in their communities and be mentored by supportive adults, said Kathleen Ethier, the director of the CDC's Division of Adolescent and School Health. A 2021 survey for the LGBTQ advocacy group, the Trevor Project, found that half of LGBTQ youth say school is an affirming place for their sexual or gender identity, compared to one in three who said they have an affirming home life. Environments that support their identities can prove to be a lifeline for LGBTQ young people and correlate to lower rates of suicide attempts. Over 70% of respondents said they turned to online spaces for that support. Whoa, we have a long way to go. Okay, well, I'd like to close this episode with a news story that I consider epic good news, particularly for us health science journalists folks. This from nutritionfacts.org. Sci-Hub offers the quickest, easiest, and greatest access to science. Sci-Hub is the portal with the quickest, easiest, and greatest access to science, but there's a catch. In 2016, the Washington Post wrote about Alexandra Elbakan, the 27-year-old graduate student from Kazakhstan, is operating a searchable online database of nearly 50 million stolen scholarly journal articles, shattering the $10 billion per year paywall of academic publishers. Her creation, Sci-Hub, is an awe-inspiring act of altruism or a massive criminal enterprise, depending on whom you ask. I say an awe-inspiring act of altruism. Elbakan's site now hosts around 60 million papers, providing access to nearly all scholarly literature via its websites sci-hub-tw and sci-hub.st. Sci-Hub has been able to fill 99.3% of article requests, all for free. A sister site, Library Genesis, currently at gen.lib.rus.ec, distributes more than a million scientific books and textbooks for free, also illegally. Elsevier, the largest publisher charging for article access, sued Sci-Hub, Library Genesis, Miss Elbakan, and 99 John Does for copyright infringement. Elsevier does not pay the authors of papers it publishes, and researchers are typically thrilled when their work is consulted or cited. In her defense, Ms. Elbakan has cited Article 27 of the United States Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Quote, "Everyone has the right freely to participate in the cultural life of the community, to enjoy the arts, to share in scientific advancement and its benefits." Woo-hoo! A big woo-hoo for that epically illegal but altruistic act. Why don't we just change the law and change society a bit so that doesn't have to be illegal? Let's line up altruism and legality. Probably never happen completely, but let's see what we can do. Okay, well, now close the show with bonus articles. It looks like I'm hovering around a new normal of 21 articles. These bonus articles are a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. available online, just like all the stories I report on this in this episode. I'll give you the link at the end of the list. So here we go, 21 stories. One, we need to clarify the goal of our COVID booster strategy. The focus should be on stopping severe disease and expanding our vaccine arsenal. Two, America's choose-your-own-adventure vaccine approach. Yeah, that's America. Three, 44 countries have COVID vaccination rates under 20% despite supply increase. Four, while we line up for a fourth shot, the world's poor haven't gotten their first. Five, there's no return to normal for millions of children orphaned during COVID. Six, how can we put COVID behind us without guaranteed paid sick leave? Really good question. Seven, COVID's racial disparities made some white people less vigilant about the virus. Another sign of white supremacy. And a very interesting article on human behavior and risk-taking. Eight, what skydivers can teach us about pandemic risk-taking? With greater protection comes greater risk-taking. Nine, what's next with face masks? Keep wearing them in public, wear the best mask available, and pay attention to fit. 10. Women are calling out medical gaslighting. Studies show female patients and people of color are more likely to have their symptoms dismissed by medical providers. Experts say, keep asking questions. 11. Black students experiencing racism on campus lack mental health support. 12. Anti-trans laws will have a chilling effect on medicine. And for some technology and data stories, 13. The power of massive databases and trials to unlock precision medicine. 14. Digital health is overlooking its biggest opportunity for disruption, empowering providers instead of profit-making. 15. As research grows on primary care and serious mental illness, a glaring gap remains between individual versus system-wide interventions. And switching it up to some environmental, 16. How to compost and why it's good for the environment. If we don't protect our planet, we all gonna die, folks. 17. Traditional knowledge guides protection of planetary health in Finland. This may seem like a little bit of a longer shot for public health, but definitely planetary health is worldwide public health. And perhaps the difference between surviving and dying on this planet will require traditional knowledge from indigenous communities. Let's listen and learn and act from them. 18. EPA decides against limiting perchlorate in drinking water. 19. She's supposed to protect Americans from toxic chemicals. First, she just has to fix Trump's mess and decades of neglect. Biden's promise to prioritize people over polluters. His person to deliver that is facing a bare bones budget, demoralized staff, and increasingly angry advocates. 20. How the California industrial community embodies the deadly link between pollution and gun violence, highlighting powerful social determinants of health. And lastly but not leastly, 21. Three reasons why you feel stressed when trying to relax and what you can do about it. Welcome to stress laxing. Hopefully that one can help alleviate some of the stress that perhaps I've induced by all of these stories. You can read these and all the stories in this episode by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some time.